Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So this began with the great Chris Pratt, whom God preserve, who plays Andy Dwyer in sitcom Parks and Recreation, with which we're all familiar, aren't we?
We are indeed.
And Andy Dwyer is a wonderful character because he's a feckless no-good who only lives for his terrible indie group. That's the only thing that matters to him in his life. And what's interesting about it is that never at one moment does Andy Dwyer recognize that a band is supposed to be there for the paying public or the audience. No, the band is there for Andy Dwyer.
Entirely to entertain themselves. Yeah, which is so kind of indie, isn't it? So student.
Anyway, there's a wonderful sequence in Parks and Recreation. It's not on anymore, but you can catch up with it on YouTube or whatever, where he apparently Chris Pratt just improvised this list to camera of all the past names that his band had. And I'm just going to run through them now. They were Teddy Bear Suicide, Mouse Rat, God Hates Figs, Department of Homeland Obscurity, Flames for Flames, Muscle Confusion, Nothing Rhymes with Orange, followed by Everything rhymes with orange. Punch Face Champions, Rad Wagon, Puppy Pendulum, Possum Pendulum, Penis Pendulum, Handrail Suicide, which has got something about Handrail Suicide that's got the right number of syllables somehow for that kind of name. Angel Snack, and then my personal favorite, Just the Tip, which is
The Scarecrow Boat, we had them. I can't remember.
There's the last one. Just the Tip is followed by Three Skin, Jet Black Pope, and Scarecrow Boat. And so they're an absolutely brilliant list. And so I posted on Twitter, said, you know, we're doing a bit of a survey of people's past bands, and many were the responses. Some from friends of the pod, or people we've had on the podcast or Word in Your Attic or whatever over the last year. Henry Priestman, who we may have talked about this when he was on, Desmond's Leg, and then Albert Dock and the Cod Warriors, I think he talked about. Sid Griffin, slightly more straight, actually, Sid's. The Frosties, The Unclaimed, House Wax, and Death Wish. Will Birch had a group called No Soap Radio and the Rollers in 1971, which is pretty
ahead of the game.
I would have thought it is. So.
Yeah.
Martin Waits, Tractors Are Go and Dennis. Mark Billingham, Lord Snooty and His Pals.
I think that's fantastically good. It's a bit like Richard Thompson had a group with Hugh Cornwell called Emil and the Detectives.
Absolutely.
It's just somebody and the somebodies. You know,
and Emily and the Detectives.
Emil
and the Detectives, I think, was the name of a children's book.
It was. That's the whole point. Okay. Yeah, that's the gag.
So, and the other one that Mark, this is showing his future as a writer. His other proposed name was Misspelt Ruth. So the idea is that truth is misspelt as R-U-T-H. Sorry, you'd have to see it on a poster. Of which more later, actually. Danny Baker says he had a friend of his wife was a lead singer in a group called Hepatitis Risk. And I love this. Rob Manuel says syphilis. We were 12. The idea that a bunch of 12-year-olds form a group called Syphilis. Nikki Campbell was apparently in a group called Tree Stump Wake. It's extraordinary, really, isn't it? Ian Rankin, the Dancing Pigs, Samuel Fullman, Evil Knocky Men, Squall, Frogspawn Candy, Seminole Beach, Math and O'Cuss, Come See the Narwhal, and so forth. And Graham Reed. So I was in a group called Scrotum Necrophilia, who came from Newmarket.
It's fantastic.
It's just, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. It's a whole, kind of region of, I don't know if you call it literature or, you know, invention, that is just out there on its own, isn't it? You know, these
it is.
Go on.
Well, I was going to say, the ones that struck me were the kind of random words kind of thrown together, which meant to elicit a kind of sense of kind of stoned wonder and goofiness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you've got, and you know that their ambition would have been one single play on the John Peel show. So you've got the ones I scribbled down were the protoplasmic membrane, the approachable pigeons, carnivorous butterflies, the mandible rumpus. That's great.
Wow.
Vaseline symphonia, telepathic gumboots, penguin steak, aardvark birthmark, flat rabbit. That's flat rabbit's brilliant. You can almost date that. Don't you think? They're kind of 1970, 71, Marquee Club, quintessence of toast and sexual furniture. Thought they were really good. And those somebody in the somebody's like the Emil and the detectives, you know, Frank interview and the interrogators, somebody had, Vic Sinex and the nasal sprays. And I can remember I knew some medical students who had a group called Dickie Hart and the Pacemakers. I mean, those things are brilliant, aren't they?
Is there a difference, Alex, between kind of real names and names that just bands, they're due to do a party or they go, you know, they're going to play at the school dance or whatever. And then somebody says to them quite late in the day, what's your name? And they go, oh, we haven't really got one or whatever. And so they quickly magic up some joke name. Is that the case? Or is there a definite difference between a name that's supposed to be there to stay and a name that's just there to get you through the weekend?
Well, I think Ned's Atomic Dustbin are proof of there's not really an awful lot of difference. I remember when I was in school and we were moving up to sixth form. We had our band. It's called Blue Blood, which is an awful name. But we were informed that...
Well, it's an awful name.
Teetering on the edge of awful. We were informed that the rival school who were coming to our sixth forms band were ready to challenge our supremacy, and they were going to go all the way to the top. And this band, this completely threatening band from Studley High School, were called the Badgers.
The Badgers.
And they were obviously convinced that the Badgers were going to go all the way through Top of the Pops and beyond. And
so there's something about their name that was kind of serious. They sort of meant it. I suppose that's the point I'm getting at, you know, is that when people name their school bands, they're kind of trying to take the mickey out themselves before anybody else does. Is that the case in the naming of themselves?
That's an interesting theory. Maybe it is, actually. Maybe it is a kind of device. Or maybe they just thought, well, what's the most fierce animal we can think of? Badger. Yeah. Badgers are hard as nails, isn't it?
Well, no, I think you're right. Steely Dan were called Leather Canary, weren't they?
Wow.
And Pearl Jam were called Mookie Blaylock. You know, Kiss were called Wicked Lester, I think. And you kind of think at some point someone's thinking, that's not quite good enough. But there are certain names that, and the one I've always found really difficult was Prefab Sprout. Because Prefab Sprout sounds like one of those goofy kind of, what we call ourselves on Friday night. And they finished up with it, oh, not as bad as the actually, but Prefab Sprout. And they finished up, I think, hobbling themselves throughout their entire career. Because I really like Prefab Sprout's music, but you cannot imagine a South Bank show special on Prefab Sprout. You can't imagine a Radio 4 announcer
that's
saying,
really true.
And we've got this afternoon a documentary about the incredible music of Prefab. You just can't imagine being able to say it.
I know what you mean. I know it's entirely just what work. You mean. You know, if somebody says,
shot themselves in the
foot. Somebody corners you at a party and says, what kind of music do you like? I can't imagine the first sentence is going to contain the words Prefab Sprout.
It wouldn't.
Yeah. Because I suppose it would be partly because anybody who wasn't familiar with them would find it kind of risible, wouldn't they, as a name?
Yeah, and, completely. And that, but
going back to, you know, it's very difficult assessing names in retrospect, isn't it? Because if Led Zeppelin hadn't been successful, you know, I mean,
would that now be a ludicrous name?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it would, because it's to do with familiarity, isn't it? You know, the Arctic Monkeys, I can remember thinking that was an absolutely dreadful name. It just goes nowhere. I still do think it's a dreadful name, actually, but you're kind of inured to it, aren't you? It just once things become familiar, you stop standing outside of them and looking at them in that kind of, in that disengaged way, and you just accept them. They're just a name.
The Beatles is an awful name.
Oh, the Beatles terrible, one of the worst name ever. But there are certain names I can remember as a kid hearing the name Steppenwolf. Obviously, Herman Hesse novel. But I remember thinking that's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain names: Foo Fighters, Talking Heads, REM, Van Halen. They're just wonderful names, and you're off to a good start. You know.
Yeah, they just somehow sound confident, don't they?
Yeah, completely.
In a way that loads of these don't.
Steppenwolf just sound magical and heavy. You know, and I just thought I've got to go and hear a group called Steppenwolf.
Yeah,
it worked. You know.
So what's the best band name ever, Alex?
The best band name ever. Well, I can tell you, it's not the Pigeon Detectives.
No.
I think the Strokes is a great band name. I think there's something really elegant about the Strokes as a phrase. You know.
Okay. What about you, Mark?
Oh, God. Best band. I don't know. I think I've always been very taken by Foo Fighters. Well, that was great because it has a, once you find out what it means, you know, the UFO fighters, isn't it? You know, that and all the folklore around that, it makes it even more kind of resonant. But it just sounds a beautiful sounding word. It looks good written down, Foo Fighters.
I think the best name is the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
It's just an absolutely brilliant name. And it was from a song. So heritage with it, you know, and you can shorten it to the Stones, all that kind of stuff. It just works. It appears to have done quite well by them, doesn't it?
Over the years.
Absolutely.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So, Dave, whistling is back.
I understand.
Whistling has returned in the shape of Molly Lewis, who's a kind of Los Angeles rising star. And I think won some kind of whistling prize in 2005 or whatever. And is now and made a bit of a reputation, you know, covering gospel songs like Just a Closer Walk with Thee and doing Mozart's The Queen of the Night aria from The Magic Flute and pop classics. And she's now made a major name for herself. And it just made me think, whistling in pop music. What a lovely thing.
Yeah, whistling pre-rock and roll. I mean,
pre-rock and roll.
Was always a kind of, it was a whole genre, wasn't it, really?
It was.
There is even a term for it. You know, the term is siffleur.
Oh, okay.
Siffleur is they describe the profession.
Oh, okay.
You know, there was people who specialised in this in the days of the musical and vaudeville and so forth. And even to the extent that you probably don't remember, but I'm old enough to remember, that a regular feature of TV variety programs in the 50s and 60s would be a chap called Ronnie Ranald. And Ronnie used to you know, come out to the audience and present as if to sing, but instead he would pucker up and he would whistle soulfully, you know what I mean? And that's what we considered part of entertainment.
God, I remember Percy Edwards. Was that a bit later?
Probably a little.
It was mostly kind of birdsong impersonation, wasn't it?
Yeah. So this woman's bringing it back. And so she's doing it in a slightly more soulful, serious vein, isn't she, really? It's not end of the pier stuff, is it?
No,
really?
It's high art. But also, it still doesn't get over the problem which Brian Ferry had on the Jealous Guy video, which is that it's very hard to whistle and not look faintly ridiculous. Brian Ferry and his tux trying hard to look incredibly cool. Yeah, he's whistling, you know. It's very hard, really.
Yes, and the harder you try, the more ridiculous you look, I suppose. You can't do it. You can't whistle in a relaxed fashion, can you?
No, because you can only have one facial expression if you're whistling anyway. So you're very, very restricted in what you can put across. But my first major memory of it when I was about 12, was whistling Jack Smith. Do you remember? I was
Kaiser Bill's Batman.
That was actually a member of the Mike Sam Singers, and there was no whistling Jack Smith, but there was a very good-looking actor called Kobe Wells, who was employed to be whistling Jack, and went round the country, obviously unable to whistle, therefore did an entire mime tour, miming their record.
Really?
Yeah, that's brilliant, isn't it?
That's extraordinary. But the whistle does turn up, you know, regularly in pop music. I mean, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, the whistle, that was put on later, obviously, because Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was, I think I'm right in saying, was completed after Otis Redding had died, hadn't he?
Oh, was it?
Yes, I think it was. It didn't come out till after he died. And I think they fixed it in the studio. And they kind of put on the sound of the ocean and so forth. And they put on the sound of the whistling. And so, you know, because partly because that was a wonderful song and so forth, but everything about it had to be poignant. And there was something about the whistle that was sort of naturally poignant, you know.
Oh, it is.
It's a natural thing to add to that. So there's
it's kind of carefree. You've got the kind of What a Day for a Daydream. You've got Georgie Girl, New Seekers, and you've got that fantastic Peter Bjorn and John song, and Professor Longhair's Go to the Mardi Gras. Then you've got the kind of cowboy romance. Do you remember REM did a Harlan County? Do you remember that? And those spaghetti westerns. And then there's the kind of melancholy. There's Peter Gabriel's Games Without Frontiers and Roy Orbison, Here Comes the Rain, Baby. Walk Like an Egyptian, the Bangles, you know. I mean, the only problem with Your Whistling is it's very, very restricted. There's only one gear, isn't it? Is there any depth and resonance to it? Could you sit through an entire Whistling concert?
In terms of the
amount of emotional expression available, I think
I don't think I could, you know. So I think Molly Lewis is, you know, I wish her all the best, but I think she's going to have to get some other string to her bow. Possibly juggle at the same time or something like that. Yeah, there's got to be something else.
Yeah.
So what else has been going on this week? I see that Elvis Costello has defended Olivia Rodrigo over charges that she's apparently purloined one of his songs for.
Which I thought was a bit rich anyway, because, yeah, she's written a song called... is it Brutal? That's right, which is meant to be a rip-off of Pump It Up. Actually, it's not if you listen to it, really. I mean, it's a bit similar. But as Elvis says, Pump It Up was stolen from, Subterranean Homesick Blues. Dylan always said that was stolen from Too Much Monkey Business. Chuck Berry, I'm sure, nicked it from somewhere else.
Absolutely. Because, Chuck Berry, I mean, God knows, I mean, Chuck Berry is pop songwriting genius, but he never sat there and invented any of that stuff out of his head. It was all artful synthesis of everything he'd heard before, you know. His first hit, Chuck Berry, is a classic. I mean, the whole notion of originality in pop music is something that ought to be shaken up. Really.
Oh, completely.
The whole idea that you can go to a high court judge and they will listen to something. They're still arguing about Stairway to Heaven. All of these years since and think they can judge on this on the basis of these things. Chuck Berry owes his entire career to Maybelline, which is his first huge hit. That was entirely, and he would admit this himself, was taken from a country song called Ida Red, which goes back into the mists of history. Nobody really knows where he came from.
Which is a noble tradition, because Rock Around the Clock is basically Hank Williams' Move It On Over, isn't it? I mean, if you listen to Move It On Over, it is precisely the same song with slightly different lyrics, which is recorded in 1947.
And so also,
7 years later, out comes Rock
Around the Clock. But Hank Williams, you know, Hank Williams didn't sit in his hotel room the day before and make up Moving On Over. You know what I mean? These things just became part of the act over a long period of time. It's just what originality is can you hear a new way of doing it?
Yeah.
That renders it unrecognizable, really. That's the thing. But if you trace it back, you can find out how they did it. You know, so.
No, I couldn't agree, but there's a real difference between your Noel Gallagher sitting down to write Shaker Maker and thinking, I'm going to listen to I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, and I'm going to take the chord sequence for which he got sued, and the same with Whatever and How Sweet to Be an Idiot by Neil Innes. There's a real difference between that and John Lennon, who always said when he wrote All I Gotta Do, which I love, that he'd sat down to write a song like Arthur Alexander.
Yeah.
But at no point in that can you see or hear or, you know, an Arthur Alexander specific chord change or a lyric or a vocal riff or anything. It just has the spirit of one of those songs. And that's a real art, I think. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, lay off of Olivia Rodrigo and everybody else who, you know.
Precisely.
Who, They're all standing on the shoulders of previous generations. That's the nature of popular music. So we're talking about date nights further to the whistling thing. I just found this. Of course, Neil Finn had an album called Try Whistling This. Do you remember?
Oh, great. Yeah, yeah.
Which I think it's got whistling on it somewhere. I have to listen to it afterwards. Talking last week about having date nights with your record collection, devoting some overdue quality time.
Yeah.
Records that you've got and you haven't played in absolute ages, and particularly during lockdown, and suddenly finding things in them. I had a couple of things this week. I started playing this, A Tribe Called Quest, the anthology. Do you know this?
I don't know.
Which has got the likes of Can I Kick It and Award Tour, and it's kind of mid 90s hip hop, I suppose. And I thoroughly enjoyed this. It's absolutely fantastic. I remember enjoying it at the time because one of the things that was revolutionary about this music was that it was kind of a new way of doing sounds. It struck me, the kind of bass sound on these things was something you couldn't work out where it had come from at all. It didn't sound like a normal bass. Did it, was it coming out of a machine? Was it the bass? Was it the drums or whatever? And that was just, it's immensely thrilling still to this day. But the amazing thing is to reflect on the fact that Can I Kick It, which pops up absolutely everywhere still to this day, on movies and sports broadcasts and so forth. Of course, I was reading the interview with A Tribe Called Quest, and there was a huge hit. They didn't make a bean from it. Why didn't they make a bean from it? Because they had sampled Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. So
that's right. I remember that.
All the beans went to Lou Reed, right? All absolutely.
Which is disgraceful in itself, because what they'd actually nicked was Herbie Flowers' bass part. Which, in fact, I think Herbie Flowers then sued Lou Reed for at some stage and settled for a percentage of, quite rightly, because that's the signature that makes the sound.
Absolutely.
You know? The idea that Lou Reed was trousering a fat load of cash for something that he effectively didn't do apart from write one chord change. Well, it's the sound. It's the sound that they're after.
It's the sound, completely. And, of course, they made more money out of it. I mean, there'd been loads of cases of this. They make far more money out of it being stolen for a hip-hop record 40 years later than they would ever have made back in the day when the market was smaller and so forth. Well, we talked to Phil Manzanera, weren't we, the other week? And wasn't it a Phil Manzanera from a solo album of his? There was an instrumental. Which was, because he talked about this, didn't he? It was a sample for a Kanye West record. I think he made more money out of that than he made.
Huge amount, because the sales are so much more than a Phil Manzanera solo album. Incredible.
So have you been spending any quality time with? Have you lit a single candle?
The only thing I dug up was, because we did a birthday pod with a lovely guy called David Cook, in Portland, in Oregon.
Oh, right.
We were talking
right.
about Decemberists. I went back and listened to this great record, which is called The Cream Wife.
Oh, yes.
And I loved it. I'd just forgotten how much I liked it. Colin Malloy is a kind of cabin-dwelling Portland, Oregon songwriter with a very kind of literary persuasion. His sister, actually, is a male Malloy, so is a novelist. And it's very literary, and it's got songs about Japanese folk tales. It's got songs about the American Civil War. It's got yarns about murderous Ulster loyalist gangs in the mid-70s. It's got murder ballads, And I love him, actually. They obviously made that great kind of rock opera, if we dare say. It's called Hazards of Love a few years later. But I love him. And if you like those kind of songwriters who just invent fictional characters and explore imaginary worlds, people like Paddy McAloon and Richard Thompson, Robbie Robertson, I recommend him. I think he's fantastic.
One of the benefits of us doing these Word in Your Attic chats with people whose whose birthday it is, Patreon supporters, where we get them online like this, and we get them to take us through their records and their souvenirs, and they finish up by recommending the album that they think is the best record ever made and so forth. It's genuinely, after almost every one of these, I go, you know, I have to go and listen to that. I haven't listened to it in years, yeah. You know. And I've done it quite a few times. So if you've always wanted to get Mark Ellen to listen to your record, the one way to do it is to turn up as when it's your birthday. But you're going to be a Patreon supporter, first of all. And if you want to be a Patreon supporter, just go to patreon.com/wordinyourear, and you'll find further details there of how you can do the same.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So a lovely little piece on The Onion, which is...
God, The Onion's great.
It's so funny. It's so funny. It's brilliant. And it says, in a blistering condemnation of the 24-year-old multi-platinum recording artist, a coalition of music critics and pop culture writers held a press conference Monday to excoriate Lord, explaining that they just felt it was time for them to begin laying into her as hard as they could. Lord, quote, Lord has gone almost a decade without anyone calling her a disgrace, writing a think piece on her toxicity, or launching into a social media campaign to tear her down. So she really is due for all that to start happening. I thought that was really funny.
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's such a funny idea.
It's brilliant. The Onion's pastiches of music are better than everything else it does. And it does everything else really well. It does a brilliant thing. Go and look it up. About how there was a terrible incident at a record store signing. Where there were too many record store clerks, as they call them, you know, shop assistants, whatever, turning up for a Yola Tango signing. and about how there was a mad rush. And then at the end, there was just a pile of black frame spectacles. nobody could work out whose were whose. Oh, God, they're so
good.
That's
so brilliant, isn't it? Because that just so perfectly sums up the kind of core appeal of that's the kind of people who buy their records.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Oh, that's lovely.
So
only thing I thought was just one thing was talking about the idea of backlashes. I was trying to think, are there any bands? I mean, about the general thing is you get immense applause if you're lucky. You get a massive kicking and a thorough rejection by the media, and then you get ignored. And I thought, Pet Shop Boys, interesting case in point. Pet Shop Boys, has that ever been a backlash? Pet Shop Boys just a
riot. Not that I'm aware of.
And they've never been ignored. There's always been permanent, warm support for everything they did. I think it's exceptional.
Yeah, let's start one, Neil.
Let's do it.
They need one. It's the only thing missing in their career. I've been reading this. Have you read this? Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s by Tom O'Neill. And Manson, once again, comes round, as this whole thing does regularly. Because I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino.
That's right. Tarantino film.
I think it's on Netflix from Wednesday. So if you haven't seen it,
really
seen
good
it?
Film.
Have you seen
Fantastic
it, Alex?
Film.
I haven't. No, no.
And I'm not the world's biggest Tarantino fan, but I think it's really good.
It's
and you know the reason I think it's really good. Do you know the person I've only just recently discovered that I really like? Brad Pitt.
He's fantastic.
Brad Pitt is so good. Once you get past his extraordinary handsomeness, you think.
Hugely underrated.
He's just brilliant.
You remember him in Thelma and Louise? Pretty much his first big role.
Yeah, he was.
Oh,
yeah,
he's terrific.
Yeah. He's good in everything I've seen him recently. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is fantastic. Kind of, it's sort of dives in, you know, the Manson, the 69 Hollywood is the background for it. But this book is kind of weird. Because he was commissioned to write this as an article in Premiere magazine, the movie magazine, in 1998. And they wanted to publish it in 1999, which was going to be the 30th anniversary of the Manson killings, which, of course, as any pop culture fan knows, took place on the same weekend that the Beatles had their pictures taken walking across the zebra. Crossing Abbey Road. So if you want a punctuation point for the end of the 60s, that's your kind of that's your ideal thing. And it's midway between Woodstock and Altamont. You know, that happens. The story, the explanation of the murders and the terrible carnage, you know, that the Manson family inaugurated, was the narrative was kind of established by Vincent Bugliosi, who was the district attorney who prosecuted them. And like all American district attorneys, very ambitious politically, very ambitious young man, you know, and to prosecute on a high profile case is a fantastic opportunity to bring your name to the fore. And he subsequently wrote a book called Helter Skelter, which is a massive, it's the biggest best-selling true crime book ever, apparently. And his the theory as to why the Manson family embarked on their killing spree is because Manson, who harbored a career as a potential songwriter, performer, and was a mate of the Beach Boys and so forth, that he'd been promised, felt he'd been promised a recording contract by Terry Melcher, and that Terry Melcher's house that Sharon Tate and her friends were staying.
CeeLo Drive. That's CeeLo
Drive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that Manson sent his followers off to start carnage, thinking Melcher was still in the house. And he wasn't. He'd gone somewhere else. And so that's the narrative that was kind of passed down, you know, all through the years. And this book kind of sets out to debunk it, really, because he finds evidence of Melcher having spent time with Manson after the killings and before their arrests, you know, and all kinds of things. Anyway, the point is, he starts his story in 1998, starts looking into it, clearly misses the deadline in 1999. So there's your 30th anniversary gone by, you know. Keeps on working on it. You know, somebody says to him, don't let this case just take over your life. Boy, it took over his life. And he was still doing it 10 years later. Missed the 40th anniversary. By the time he came to the 50th anniversary, the magazine had gone away. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he started
yeah.
wanting their money back because they'd paid him. I mean, it's extraordinary insight into how American magazine journalism worked back in the day, Mark, which would really appeal to you. You know, they was kind of paid a retainer to do this stuff, you know.
I know, the amount of money for research and...
That's absolutely incredible. Absolutely extraordinary.
Deep investigative journalism.
And then the people he talks to, you know, some of them die, and you know, Bugliosi dies, Terry Melcher dies, all yeah. these people, and you know, the amount of information coming in from all points of the compass just grows absolutely all the time, and so it ends up with this book which came out I think last year, and of course the funny thing is, I don't know if you see here, it's written by Tom O'Neill with Dan Peepenbring, and he clearly had to get somebody else to write the book because he just had so much material.
Couldn't make sense of it.
You exactly. know what I mean?
Yeah,
He couldn't hold it together. But I have to confess, I mean, who knows why these, you know, misanthropic loons did what they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, but Mike Love wrote a memoir, which he suggests, I think he implies that was the case, actually. Whether or not for commercial reasons or whether he meant it, I don't know. That's why you know, that Charles Manson was avenging the fact that he didn't get a record deal from Terry Melcher. And also, Terry Melcher was told by his mum, Doris Day, when he told him stories about, told her stories about Manson and their guns and their knives and stuff. She said, you must move out of that house.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
he moved because she told him to. And also, the Mike Love book points out that one day Dennis dropped off Terry Melcher at his home in CeeLo Drive, and that Manson was in the car. So Manson knew where he lived. Manson was very aggrieved because the Beach Boys actually covered one of his songs called Cease to Exist.
Yeah, it's on the B-side. Wrote,
it's a B-side,
it's
that's
on the
right.
B-side, yeah.
Yeah, and then they didn't credit him. So he was pretty wound up.
You have to be reminded what royalty Terry Melcher was. Doris Day's son was like me. Like me, the son of, I can't imagine. It's like me, the son of Kylie Minogue, or, you know, absolutely. That's Terry Melcher, and I've actually got two Terry Melcher albums.
God, any good?
No, I've listened to them in years.
Blindingly handsome fellow.
Like, really handsome.
Yeah.
Can I just say, he looks, he's a spitting image of Ray Purchase from Matt Berry's Toast in that photo.
Yes, he is.
Ray Bloody Purchase.
Yes, he is.
So Terry Melcher, incredibly well connected, Hollywood royalty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Clearly very wealthy. And used to go around town with Dennis Wilson. Okay. Do you think these guys had any trouble getting sex, Alice,
I don't fancy yours much.
Yeah, I got my ugly mate with ugly, slightly less wealthy mate. You know, they used to go around Hollywood with another guy called Greg Jacobson, and they used to go under the name of the Golden Penetrators.
Nice.
Oh, Lord.
They had so much
sex. Three more from them. And
Terry Melcher lived in the house with, do you know who his girlfriend was? Candice Bergen.
That's right.
Daughter of Edgar Bergen. Again, Hollywood royalty. Yeah. You know, these people were just incredibly privileged. And so you read this book, and you can't believe a word anybody says to you in this book, because they're either small-time criminals who are dishonest as a breed, Hollywood royalty who are dishonest as a breed, or lawyers who are dishonest as a breed. You know what I mean? Who will say absolutely anything they can get away with saying, you know. So how do you believe
that? They come up with a book that you want to believe. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's like Hollywood Babylon, really, isn't it? Kind of updated.
Well, it's you can kind of see why, coming back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you can see why Quentin Tarantino made a film using that as the background.
Completely.
Because it's so kind of resonant of all kinds of things, you know. So as I say, I think it's on Netflix from
It is from an next incredible week. Film. And the very clever thing is that you do see Manson at one point, but you only see him for about, I don't know, 20 seconds or something.
Yeah.
So he's very cleverly played into the background. It's a fantastic film.
Yeah. So any other business? Have we got anything we need to cover?
New patrons?
Indeed. We'd like to welcome Marie Griffiths.
Hello, Marie.
Marie Griffiths. Very good to have you on board.
Is that Murray or Marie?
Marie.
Thank you, Marie.
Marie. James Anthony Collingwood.
Hello. It's rather rather formal, full name.
Very good. Indeed.
Edgar Robinson.
Edgar. Edgar. I think that was our first Edgar.
It is indeed our first Edgar. I can vouch for this. Ed Pritchard.
Ed Pritchard. Good. Hello, Ed.
Maybe short for Edgar. We don't know.
Good.
And Wes Shelbourne, who's an Access All Areas tier patron.
All right.
Good man.
So we'll be celebrating.
Special thank you to Wes. We'll be having a birthday with him.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Indeed.
We'll
look forward to that. So July the 17th, if you haven't already got your tickets, do so to our Word in the Park. And we're delighted to say that we've been joined. So I guess that day, Gary Crowley, Leslie Ann Jones, Barney Hoskins, Danny Baker, and
Mark Lewison.
Mark Lewison.
No, Beatles Lane
extraordinaire. So there is no better way to celebrate the return to physical interaction or in-person appearance. There won't be any physical reinteraction. It's all very carefully distanced and all very pleasant. Then that occasion, which is July the 17th, in the afternoon between 2 and 4:30. If you haven't got your tickets, do so.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.